In yet another indicator that the mainstream media is rife with corruption and conflicts of interest, CNN has now hired Laura Jarrett, daughter of Valerie Jarrett, to cover President Trump's Department of Justice. As The Blaze reports, CNN touted Jarrett's background defending companies and individuals in government investigations brought by the Justice Department. Valerie Jarrett wasn't just President Obama's top advisor. She's also personally close to the Obamas, to the extent that she's reportedly moving in with them in their new Washington, D.C. digs. Jarrett called Trump's election a punch in the stomach, soul-crushing. According to Vanity Fair, Laura Jarrett is dedicated to, quote, promoting civil rights and social equality for women and minorities. So she's probably going to be completely objective about the Trump administration, you'd think, right? Look, this is nothing new from the mainstream media Democratic Party complex. Ben Rhodes, the national security advisor to President Obama, who actively lied to the entire media about the Iran deal, is brother to David Rhodes, president of CBS. ABC News correspondent Claire Shipman, she's the wife of Jay Carney, former Obama press secretary. George Stephanopoulos, ABC News' leading anchor, he's a former Clinton staffer. Ben Sherwood, president of Disney ABC Television Group, is brother to former Obama special assistant Elizabeth Sherwood Randall. The media claim that such relationships have no bearing on coverage. Maybe. Or maybe. People with close relationships to those in power tend to favor those people in their coverage. After all, that's the entire basis of the rumors about President Trump's conflicts of interest with regard to his businesses, which are now supposedly run by his kids. Their relationship makes him more likely to act in corrupt fashion to benefit those businesses. Why wouldn't that same logic apply to the media? There's nothing wrong with assigning Valerie Jarrett's kid to cover the DOJ, but there is something wrong with pretending objectivity when it is clearer every single day that such objectivity is a figment of the media's imagination. I'm Ben Shapiro. This is The Ben Shapiro Show. Okay, lots to talk about today. We'll start with everything going on with Jeff Sessions in just a moment. But before we do that, we have to say thank you to our advertisers over at Wink. So if you are somebody who doesn't know what a sommelier is, doesn't know what a good wine is, doesn't know what wine goes with what food, you need to go over to my friends at Wink.com. This is formerly Club W. It's W-I-N-C, W-I-N-C.com. And what they do is you go there and they give you the survey and they ask you what kind of foods you like, what kind of tastes you like, and then they recommend a wine that is specifically for you, a wine that is personalized to your taste buds. And it's great if you know what your friends like and you know what they're having for dinner and you want to bring over a bottle of wine that matches what they're having and want to look like you're not an ignoramus about wine, which I am. The wine is apparently fantastic. People around the office have been drunk for months off of Wink.com wine, which is why the quality of the podcast has been so poor lately. But Wink.com is the place that you can go for that kind of great wine. Wink is offering my listeners $20 off right now when you go to trywink.com/Ben. Trywink.com/Ben. WINC.com/Ben. And they cover the shipping. So you get that fine wine personalized to your palate, delivered right to your door. And it's really cheap. I mean, a lot of these bottles of wine are like $10 a piece. You can get a couple of bottles of wine, $20 off when you go to trywink.com/Ben. You get complimentary shipping right now. Trywink.com/Ben. Make sure that you use the slash Ben so you get that $20 discount and also so that they know that we sent you. Okay, so we begin the day with the story of the day. And the story of the day is supposedly that Jeff Sessions is the most nefarious character that ever was. So the attorney general for the Trump administration is supposedly this guy who is just awful, awful, awful. Why is he so awful? Because he met with the Ruskies. He met with the Ruskies, just like everybody else in the Trump administration. Apparently, he met with the evil, evil, evil Ruskies. And that means that he has to be stopped, right? I mean, the fact is that the Ruskies have been trying to get the Trump administration in their pocket, and now here comes Jeff Sessions trying to explain, you know, trying to work the back room, basically. Here is the problem with all of that, okay? So there are a bunch of problems with this particular set of nonsense. I'll go through the entire story from the beginning because it's a little bit confusing. So here it is. He's the latest figure to come under heavy fire. Here's what you need to know. He testified back in January, I guess, that he hadn't met with the Russians when he was just a senator. He was not yet AG. And it was unclear whether he testified he hadn't met the Russians in his capacity as somebody on the Trump campaign or whether he hadn't met the Russians in his capacity at all. What he said, Al Franken asked Sessions what he would do if he learned of communications with the Russians from the Trump campaign, and Sessions said, "I've been called a surrogate a time or two in that campaign. I did not have communications with the Russians." So is that a denial of any contact, or is it a denial of contact as a surrogate? Not really clear, because you could say, look, as a senator, yeah, I met with the Russian ambassador, but we didn't discuss the campaign, so it didn't have anything to do with Trump. Senator Pat Leahy asked Sessions in writing, quote, "Have you been in contact with anyone connected to any part of the Russian government about the 2016 election, either before or after Election Day?" And Sessions said no. And Sessions issued a statement saying he did not meet with any Russian officials now to discuss issues of the campaign. So now he's changing his story a little bit. So this sort of back and forth has really hurt Sessions, because it now turns out that Sessions met twice, that Sessions met with the Russians two times. So what does that mean? Did anything nefarious happen? No evidence that anything nefarious happened. He could have met with them to talk. He's on the Armed Services Committee. He could have met with them to talk about that sort of stuff. Is it possible he talked with them about the campaign? Sure. But the problem is that now that he testified in front of Congress that he didn't, or at least he didn't in a certain capacity, and the language is a little bit vague, there are a lot of people calling for his recusal. There are a bunch of people in the Senate who have said that they don't routinely meet with the Russians. 20 lawmakers from the Armed Services Committee told the Washington Post they didn't meet with the Russian ambassador last year. But a bunch of senators have also said it's not out of the realm of possibility or out of the realm of normalcy for senators to meet with the Russian ambassador. You know, Claire McCaskill, who has said that Sessions should resign for perjury, she said she's never met with the Russian ambassador. And then it turns out she met with him in 2013. So a lot of these senators have met with the Russian ambassador. This looks like a lot of smoke and no fire. It doesn't even look like real smoke. It's just like a bunch of crap, honestly. It looks like a smear job out to get Sessions the day after Donald Trump goes on his triumphant tour, because he gave a good speech to the joint session of Congress. So all the Democrats are universally calling for his resignation. And this is where the Democrats are really, really stupid. So they don't have the capacity to just, in moderate fashion, say something obvious like maybe he should recuse himself. And that'd be one thing. You could say, okay, look, whether he did something good or bad or not, it doesn't really matter. Now people are going to think no matter what he does, it's corrupt, so he should recuse himself. That's a fair argument. It's a fair argument. I don't think it's a great argument, but it's a fair argument. But instead, they're saying he should resign. So you have people like Nancy Pelosi saying, after lying under oath to Congress about his communications with the Russians, the attorney general must resign. And then she was joined in that call by Elizabeth Warren, among others. Listen, Eric Holder, the Obama attorney general, he didn't resign despite a scandal-plagued career ranging from Fast and Furious to overseeing journalists and attempting to prosecute journalists. He was actually held in contempt of Congress and he didn't resign. Loretta Lynch, as you recall, the attorney general under President Obama after Holder, she refused to recuse herself from the investigation of Hillary Clinton. She said she wasn't going to interfere unless it went the way she didn't want, in which case she would interfere. So for Democrats to suddenly say that Sessions has to recuse himself based on he once met with the Russian ambassador is really over the top. But saying that he should resign is super duper duper over the top. Trump says it's a partisan hit job, and he's basically right. The White House Deputy Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders, she says this is the latest attack against the Trump administration by partisan Democrats. Attorney General Sessions met with the ambassador in an official capacity as a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, which is entirely consistent with his testimony. It's no surprise Senator Al Franken is pushing this story immediately following President Trump's successful address to the nation. Here's my deal. Okay, folks, here's my deal. I am always going to call balls and strikes. I'm always going to call balls and strikes no matter who's at bat, because that's all that matters is the balls and the strikes. What is right and what is wrong, not the person at bat. If Trump's at bat, I'm going to call balls and strikes. If the Democrats are at bat, I'm going to call balls and strikes. Okay, so this one is a ball. I'm sorry, this is not a major story. There's no evidence that Sessions is deliberately lying about meeting with the Russian ambassador for some nefarious reason. Should he recuse himself is a second question. And that second question is basically, is he so compromised at this point that any investigation he does will be compromised? That's possible. That is possible. And there are good arguments both ways. On the one hand, there's that argument. On the other hand, there's the argument that if anybody can basically be prevented from doing their job by a media and a Democratic Party that insists that every minor problem is a major problem, then nothing's ever going to get done. If you're accusing yourself over, I once met the Russian ambassador at my office, then what won't you recuse yourself over? What can you actually do? That's a serious problem for the Trump administration. It looks, in all likelihood, like Sessions will just recuse himself on this thing. That doesn't mean there will be a special prosecutor, by the way. It just means that his deputy will end up prosecuting this thing. And his deputy, presumably, would probably act the same way that he would, because his deputy will be appointed in coordination with President Trump by him. So, you know, the idea that he is going to somehow not be able to have control over the investigation is just not true. As an example, the deputy attorney general for Loretta Lynch was that lady who refused to prosecute Donald Trump's executive order and ended up being fired. So the deputy attorney general ends up looking a lot like the attorney general under whom they serve. But here's my bottom line. This thing looks way overblown, even for people like me who are suspicious of Donald Trump's relations with the Russians, because there's a lot of smoke, but we haven't seen any real fire yet. Even for somebody like me who looks at Paul Manafort and says, that's kind of weird, and looks at Donald Trump constantly praising Putin and says, well, that's kind of weird, and looks at the fact that Michael Flynn was so warm with Vladimir Putin and said, that's kind of weird. Even for me, this is a nothing burger of a story. And again, balls and strikes are all that matters. I'm not going to rip Trump for doing something I don't think is particularly wrong. That said, it's pretty clear that the Democrats are losing their minds, and they're particularly losing their minds over this moment with Karen Owens. And I want to talk about this briefly because we ran a story a couple of days ago in which we talked about the Democrats not standing up for Karen Owens. And people took that to mean that we were saying that they had never stood up for Karen Owens. We never claimed that they never stood up for Karen Owens. What we said, as I said on the podcast yesterday, was that the Democrats stood at the beginning and then they sat down. And then they sat down. And when people say, well, they sat down, it's not a big deal, then why is it that in all the pictures you can see that half the room is sitting and half the room is standing? If it wasn't coordinated, if it wasn't a matter of partisanship, then why is it that half the room is standing and half the room is sitting? Why wouldn't it just be a bunch of randos who are kind of standing and sitting together? Why wouldn't some Republicans have sit and some Democrats sit? Everybody just got tired and bored, and so they sat down. But that's not what it looks like. You can see the pictures. Half the room is sitting, half the room is standing during the second ovation. Not the initial ovation. Everybody stands for the initial ovation. Here's what I actually wrote, okay? Democrats initially stood for the widow, but then they sat. Trump didn't. Okay, so I was very clear about this. Nonetheless, Snopes and PolitiFact, instead of ranking as half true or totally true the claim that Democrats sat down for the video, they said that it was completely false, which I have pictures. And so does Benny Johnson. Benny Johnson is the guy who initially reported this from IJ Review, and he tweeted out pictures of Keith Ellison and Debbie Wasserman Schultz sitting down in the middle of the second ovation. And you can see it in his picture. I mean, I'm looking at the picture right now, right before me. And he's not the only one. I mean, they're sitting down. An entire body of the Democratic Party is sitting down. Bernie Sanders and Nancy Pelosi, by the end, are sitting down, which is exactly what we wrote in the piece. But again, PolitiFact and Snopes and the rest of these fact checkers are lefties, and so they feel the need to overreach because they're desperate to disprove the idea that Democrats made a boo-boo by not standing up the whole time, which they obviously should have. Okay, that's just one indicator of how the Democrats are overplaying their hand, but they're losing their minds in general because anytime Trump does something good and isn't a universal crap show, they begin to go crazy. So Michael Moore, you know, again, going off on this whole Karen Owens thing, he's suggesting that Donald Trump used the Seal widow. So here's what he had to say.
Of course, and that's why she's there.
Yeah,
as a sort of a FU to the people who are criticizing him for this. And this poor woman, this widow who has lost her husband, she is in desperate grief right now.
She's in love with her husband still.
And in love with her husband.
And what did you think of
that? And to use that as just put another notch on his belt. And what's he thinking about? My ratings.
Okay, and so Moore is very upset. Okay, as I said yesterday, two things can be true at once. One can be that Trump wanted to honor her. The second can be that Donald Trump was using her as a political prop. Okay, I'm just going to be perfectly frank about this. Politicians use people as political props all the time. Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton stood in front of the flag-draped coffins from Benghazi and lied to the families of Benghazi for political gain. Barack Obama in 2014 invited a wounded warrior to the State of the Union. Did he do so because he was so respectful of the troops, or did he do so as a political prop? And the answer is maybe both, right? It can be both. You know, Barack Obama, he's done the same routine multiple times. Hillary Clinton trotted out Kaiser Khan, right? Gold Star family, and this became a major issue in the campaign. She tried out Kaiser Khan to rip into Donald Trump over Kaiser Khan's son being killed in Iraq, right? And Kaiser Khan rips into Trump. Was that Hillary Clinton using them as a prop? It's really funny. Every time somebody on the right brings out a family member of somebody who's been slain in the line of duty, then they're a political prop, according to the Democrats. So when Republicans talk about Pat Smith, who's the mother of Sean Smith, who was killed in Benghazi, then she was just a political prop. But every time the Democrats tried out a Cindy Sheehan, or every time they tried out the Jersey Girls, you know, from 9/11, these are heroes who cannot be questioned under any circumstances. Here is the reality. Politicians will always use people who are suffering. They'll always use victims as a little bit of political theater. They'll always do that. That doesn't change the fact that this woman wanted to be there. And I thought Mary Catherine Hamm of CNN had the exact right take on this, which was, you know, the Ryan Owens' widow, Karen Owens, she has every right to be there. She has every right to feel the applause of the entire nation shower down upon her in thanks. And one day she'll be able to show her kids the tape of when their father was cheered by the entire nation at a State of the Union address. So, you know, the Democrats are losing their minds over this. Jake Tapper at CNN, whose reporting I generally like, he also went after Trump because Trump at one point apparently had said about the Yemen raid, they lost Ryan, and meaning the military, meaning the generals. And Jake Tapper objected to this, meaning you authorized the raid. Why don't you say we lost Ryan? Why do you make it about they? It's nitpicky.
They lost Ryan. Quote, they lost Ryan. But they didn't lose him. We did. We all did as a nation, and one might think that the commander-in-chief who signed off on that raid would also think in terms of we lost Ryan. Accountability and responsibility, these are important principles.
Okay, so, you know, this is a little bit of an overstate by Tapper. You know, let's see what comes out about this Yemen raid, whether there was actual intelligence gathered. There's a lot of controversy over that. But, you know, trying to say that Trump is somehow disrespecting the memory of this guy, I think that's an overstatement. Mike Pence, I think, hits this right on the head. He says all of this is a great disservice to the family.
Does that make you angry? You seem like a calm guy. That made me angry. And then make you angry?
It does a great disservice to a great American family.
And I think that's totally fair. I mean, ripping her, and there are people who ripped her, saying that she was used and she allowed herself to be used. Again, it's her choice to be there. If you're going to rip Trump for using her, then you have to show that he used her and didn't honor her, and I'm not sure that that happened. I think that's, again, a wild overstatement by desperate Democrats. How desperate are the Democrats at this point? They're so desperate that they're thinking toward 2020, and they're looking at their field, and they're realizing that their field is barren. There is nothing there. Right? Their field is just totally empty. So the question becomes, okay, well, if their field is totally empty, who will they go for? They have an idea. Their idea. Oprah Winfrey. Oh, yes. Here she goes.
Have you ever thought that given the popularity you have, we haven't broken the glass ceiling yet for women, that you could actually run for president and actually be elected?
I actually never thought I never considered the question even a possibility. I just thought, oh.
Right, because it's clear that you don't need government experience to be elected president of the United
States,
right?
I thought, oh, gee, I don't have the experience. I don't know enough. I don't know. And now I'm thinking, oh.
All right. Well, okay.
Okay, so now they're talking about Oprah's going to run for president. And you knew that this is the lesson the Democrats were going to take away. They're not going to take away the lesson that they have failed to appeal to blue-collar people. They're not going to take away the lesson that they had the world's crappiest candidate in Hillary Clinton. Because here's the reality. If Joe Biden runs in that election cycle, very high probability that Joe Biden is president of the United States right now. They're not going to take away the right lessons from this. Instead, they're going to take away Donald Trump was a celebrity, and now we need our own celebrity. Because this is how political parties think, because political parties are parties of groupthink and stupidity. So it'll be Tom Hanks or Oprah Winfrey, and the Democrats are over the moon about this. And we'll get to Chris Matthew. I'll be like, say, well, yeah, say by Oprah. We'll get to that in a second. But for that, you have to go over to dailywire.com and become a subscriber if you want to watch it live. You can be part of the mailbag today. We're going to do a lot of live questions from the mailbag. So finally, your opportunity to sound off at dailywire.com. $8 a month gets you access to dailywire.com. You can watch this show live. You can also watch Klavan's show live. We're going to have, right now we're giving away free copies of the DVD of The Arroyo, which is the fictional film set on the southern border about the drug cartels taking over the southern border and using it for illegal immigration and such. It's a very good film, and you can check it out over our Facebook page as well. But if you want a copy of it, you can get it for free by being an annual subscriber to dailywire.com. Or if you want to listen to the show later, go over to SoundCloud or iTunes. And if you listen over at iTunes, then make sure that you leave a review. We are the top conservative podcast in the nation. So Democrats take every single lesson the wrong way. So Oprah says, maybe I can run. Now, how would Oprah actually do if she ran? Well, I think that, you know, she'd do better than Hillary because she's not Hillary Clinton. She campaigned openly for President Obama. What people forget about when Oprah campaigned openly for Obama in 2008, she lost a lot of viewers. She lost a lot of viewers. Oprah's entire appeal is being a not partisan person. And once she becomes a partisan person and she allows her partisanship to get the better of her, she is not nearly as popular. Oprah's popularity rests on the idea that she's an aspirational figure who helps you reach new depths of yourself that you've never plumbed and helps you reach new heights of achievement that you've never achieved. That's what Oprah's about. She's about making you feel good. Politics doesn't make people feel good. Politics makes people feel really bad, generally. And so Oprah Winfrey becoming a partisan political figure, it would actually be difficult. Because what happens when she's asked about abortion? And then she says that she's pro-choice. There are a lot of women who are going to say, nah. What happens when she's asked about Muslim immigration to the country and suddenly she has to take a hard and fast position on the level of vetting that is necessary for Muslim refugees? When policy hits the road, like Trump's policies, a lot of them were very flawed, but he at least had a grasp of some of them, and his figure was all about polarization. Trump was always about polarization. Trump was never a widely beloved, universally beloved figure. He wasn't Dr. Phil. Trump was always the bad guy on the show. He's more like Simon Cowell running for president than like Paula Abdul. But Oprah is more like Paula Abdul. I don't know how you square that exactly with a successful political candidacy. I think everybody thinks that she would run and she'd wipe out Trump. I'm not sure that that's the case at all, because I'm not sure that politics is a game of claws, and Oprah, when she brings out the claws, is not Oprah anymore. She actually gets away from her core brand. Chris Matthews, though, is over the moon about this. He says that Oprah would be great. I get up in the morning, I brush my hair, shoo, come on here, think about Oprah all day long. Don't wrinkle. My shirts are wrinkled. My tie is wrinkled. Everything is, my face is wrinkled. And then I come here, I talk about Oprah. What say you, Michael Isikoff? Go.
No politics, and every election is about fixing the problem we have. I think Oprah, not that she's a serious candidate, because she doesn't want to be probably, is empathy. Right now, we have a president who has no empathy for regular people and their problems. He doesn't connect with pain. He doesn't feel the pain of the people he makes fun of. He has no empathy. It's Oprah's strength. I've watched her for decades. She connects with women, whatever their ethnic background, whatever the gender is. She connects with people's real challenges in life. That's what we need right now in this country, a little empathy.
Okay, so if the Democrats think that empathy is what's going to win the day, empathy doesn't win the day in politics. It's making the other side look like they're not empathetic. Everybody already knows Trump isn't very empathetic. Everybody already knows that Trump reserves his greatest empathy for Trump. There's also the point that empathy isn't a great thing in politics. I mean, I've discussed this before. When you are empathetic toward one person, you tend to ignore the broader policy implications of what you're talking about because you're focusing in on that one person, and that's not always a great political move. Also, if Oprah's shtick is empathy, and then she has to attack Trump, or she is attacked, what does she do? What does she do? You know, I'm not sure that this works exactly the way Democrats want it to work. They thought that Hillary was much more empathetic than Trump, and Hillary ended up losing. Now, I don't think it's all about empathy. I think there's also something to do with strength and with the ability to attack. And I mean, negative campaigning works. I'm not sure how Oprah participates in negative campaigning. Does it make me happy that we're talking about Oprah as a presidential candidate? No, but it didn't make me happy that we were talking about Trump as a presidential candidate. Maybe he'll still be good. Maybe he'll be good. Like, so far, I like a lot of his policies. I do. But I'm not a big fan of the president as a celebrity, but I think that's a natural result of what Obama did to the office of the presidency, making it into a celebrity reality show, and then Trump basically just filled into that gap, and wouldn't be a surprise to see an all-celebrity lineup from here on out. But if it's not that, it's so funny. The Democrats are so desperate that they are now turning back to old faces like Eric Holder. Okay, so Holder told reporters that he's interested in returning to politics publicly. Holder apparently said that Obama is going to return also. He said that it's coming. This is what Holder said about President Obama. Holder said, it's coming. He's coming, and he's ready to roll. Obama will be a more visible part of the effort. The best thing that could happen to Republicans right now is for Barack Obama to suck all the oxygen out of the room. It would be just glorious, because Obama's gone. No one wants to hear from him. No one is interested in what he has to say. We just made him go bye-bye. We don't want him to come back. And when Barack Obama makes himself the head of the Democratic Party again, all he's doing is sucking all the oxygen out of the room. If he's the lead attack dog, let's say two people attack Trump. Let's say one is Obama and the other is Cory Booker. Only one of those two people can run for president. Who do you think the headlines will be about? Of course, they'll be about Obama. Obama's a much bigger political figure. And the same thing is true for Obama and anyone. The more Obama talks, the more he sucks the air out of the room for all the other Democrats. Republicans should be begging for Obama to come back, but Democrats are so desperate for Obama to hold together their failing coalition, their fraying coalition, that they think that if they just drag him out and trot him around, that's going to help. It's never worked before. It really hasn't. I mean, this idea that you can just try to... I mean, Obama worked hard for Hillary Clinton. It didn't work. Popularity is not transferable. It is not transferable. Bill Clinton was not able to transfer his popularity over to Al Gore. Barack Obama was not able to transfer his popularity over to Hillary Clinton. And so if they think that Obama's going to come and make them real popular again, and then that will translate into their victory, Obama couldn't even do that when he was president. He devastated the entire party down ballot. They lost 1,000 seats in state legislatures. They now control one-third of the governorships. Okay, they're in serious trouble here because of Barack Obama, and they're so addicted to Obama that they're going back to the well for more. Really, really, really stupid. Really stupid. So the Democrats are relegated to just ripping Trump, and they have no forward strategy, and that's a disaster for them. Okay, I want to do some things I like and things I hate, and we'll do some pretty significant mailbag time here today. So, okay, time for some things I like. So, things that I like this week, we've been doing pictures that should have won Best Picture but didn't. In 1979, the picture that won was Kramer versus Kramer. Kramer versus Kramer is a very good movie. I've recommended it on this show before. It's about Dustin Hoffman and is it Diane Keaton? It's Meryl Streep. Meryl Streep's in that. So it's Dustin Hoffman and Meryl Streep. And it's about a couple that's going through a divorce, basically. She leaves to find herself and just abandons her kid, and Dustin Hoffman has to fill the gap. It is a good movie. The best movie that year, though, is Breaking Away. Breaking Away is such a creative, fascinating film. I love this movie so much. This is a film with a bunch of young stars. You'll see a young Dennis Stern. You'll see a young Dennis Quaid. Daniel Stern, a young Dennis Quaid. You'll see a young Jackie Earle Haley. It's this great, great cast of young actors. And the whole premise is fantastic. It's about this town. It's interesting because I think it has a lot of parallels to what's going on in terms of blue-collar America today. Breaking Away is about this town, which has an industrial base, and all the people who are in the industrial base can't go to college. And it's in Bloomington, Indiana, so all the kids who are white-collar are going to Indiana University. And it's about the competition between the college kids and the kids who call themselves the Cutters. And meanwhile, one of the kids really wants to go to college, but he's conflicted because he feels like he is abandoning his blue-collar roots if he goes to college. He is also a bicyclist, and so the entire movie is about how he is a bicyclist who worships at the altar of the Italian national bicycle team, and he meets. It's charming. It's funny. It's witty. It's a great, great movie. I mean, I always forget about this movie when I talk about like my top 10, but I think that Breaking Away would really be like on the edge of the top 10. It's a fantastic film. He meets this girl, and he doesn't know what to say to her, so he ends up pretending that he's Italian. Because he's learned Italian, because he loves the Italian bicycle racing team. The score is based on a bunch of Italian music. So it's based on Rossini, and it's based on they use Mendelssohn's Italian Symphony. Mendelssohn wasn't Italian, but the Italian Symphony is great music. They use a lot of that music in it. Really funny, really charming. Has echoes for today in terms of the white collar, blue collar gap, and some of the sort of the industrial versus educated gap that exists in the country and has grown. Here's a little bit of the preview for Breaking Away.
Enrico Giamonde spends 8 hours a day training to be the finest racer in all of Italy. But Enrico has a problem. He's not in Italy. He's in Bloomington, Indiana.
Papa! Ciao, Papa!
And he's not Enrico Giamonde.
I should have hit him when I had the chance. He'd be dead now.
Oh, grazie, Tante Santa Maria.
He's Dave Stoller.
He was as normal as pumpkin pie, and now look at him.
But Dave's not crazy.
He's never tired. He's never miserable.
He's on the road to adulthood.
When I was young, I was tired and miserable.
You are numero uno, King Papa.
And he's decided to take a little detour at the age of 19.
What are we going to do about him?
I don't know, dear. We could always strangle him while he's asleep.
20th Century Fox presents Breaking Away, the story of four guys in imminent danger of turning 20.
All right!
Bravo! Right there. Yeah, so it's a great, great movie. It's got some of my favorite lines ever. The father in it is, I can't remember the name of that actor. It's killing me, but he's great. He has a couple of lines that are fantastic. He has heart problems, and there's one point where he comes in and the wife is making Italian food for the son, and he says, I don't want any of that Italian food. I want some American food. Give me some damn French fries. And it's a great movie. You have to watch the film. It's got some really deep points to make also about what it means to be an adult and understanding. There's some charming innocence to the movie. And there's also some cynicism to the movie that's really great. One of my favorite scenes, I won't give away the entire scene, but one of my favorite scenes is that the father's a used car salesman, and that means that he sort of cheats people. And his son comes in and forces his father to return a car that's been a lemon. And the father basically has a heart attack over it. And later, the son comes to him, and they have a conversation. It's a really great conversation that I think has a lot of resonance for today's politics. And basically, the father says, the son comes to, I will give it away because it doesn't really give that much away. The kid says, you know, everyone cheats. I just didn't know. And the father says, well, now you know. And that's, I think there's a lot to that. And so the question is, what values are going to hold to in a world where it seems like everyone cheats? That has a lot of resonance for today's politics. I love this movie, you can't tell. Breaking Away, 1979, should have won Best Picture. Okay, other things that I like. So, out in California, there was there's a guy who apparently does not know how to swing a baseball bat. I mean, he comes up to a police station in West Covina, and he takes a baseball bat and he starts whacking on the windows. And you're about to see a cop, if you're subscribing, you're about to see a cop exhibit perfect tackling form in taking this guy out. It's pretty fantastic. So here's this guy. He's, like, hitting the windows, but with no real force. I mean, this guy should not play baseball. And he does not have a lot of Dodger recruitment coming at him here. And he's, you know, whacking on the windows and standing out there with the baseball bat. Still a dangerous dude. And in just a few seconds, you're going to see... I don't know how you hit a window and don't break it. My goodness. I mean, that's always something that you say to somebody on your baseball team who really stinks. Is like your fastball couldn't break a pane of window, but nobody's ever said your swing can't break a pane of window. My goodness. Here comes the cop going low. Boom! And the cop takes him out right from behind. Solid tackling form. They put him down on the ground. And he goes low, and he grabs him around the waist. That's how you tackle, folks. And it seems to me a lot of the players in the NFL should get you. Here it comes again. Boom! Tough actin's an actin. Oh, yeah. There it is. Jacked up! Okay, so good stuff from that cop. Well done, police officer, who took out the guy who can't break a pane of glass with a baseball bat. Because, wow. Okay, things I hate. Things I hate. So, Amari Stoudemire used to play in the NBA, and for a while he was pretty good with the Phoenix Suns, then he gets traded to the New York Knicks, or signs there as a free agent, and he stinks. But he is getting all sorts of flack because he says that he doesn't want to shower with a gay teammate, and here is what he had to say about it.
If you listen to the speech, it sounds much different than if you're looking at it on the television. And to me, it sounds like a speech that was written for someone that he was reciting.
We do not have it. In any case, everybody's gotten into the wink wine a little bit early today. Amari Stoudemire, what he actually said was, I'm going to shower across the street, make sure my change of clothes are around the corner, and I'm going to drive, take a different route to the gym. And the interviewer asked Stoudemire if he was joking, and he said there's always truth within the joke, and everybody loses their mind. So I have a question. Would it be inappropriate, wildly inappropriate? Like, look, would I be somebody who, if I were in a locker room, I would shower in a different room if there were a gay guy there? No, because I don't care. Like, it doesn't make a difference to me. But I just to point out the double standard here. If a woman said, I don't want to shower in the same locker room as a man because the man is sexually attracted to me, is that totally off the charts crazy? Like, really, is that totally wild? Like, if a girl says, I don't want to be naked in front of the guy, not because, like, he can be dressed. It's not even a matter of him being naked. But I don't want to be naked in front of a guy in the locker room because he is sexually attracted to me. Is that okay? But when it comes to Amari Stoudemire saying this about a gay guy, I don't want to be naked in front of a gay guy because he might be sexually attracted to me, then he's a homophobe. It just shows you the sensitivity and double standard that exists with regard to folks who are gay, as though there is a higher standard for behavior or a lower standard for behavior when it comes to heterosexual people, that a heterosexual man can't control himself, and so a woman should be afraid in the locker room. And again, the double standard exists everywhere. If a man went into the locker room and said, hey, I'm a man, I'm in the locker room, we'd all say, get the hell out. If the man walks in, starts unclothing, reveals himself and says, I'm a woman now, then the entire left goes, you respect that man as a woman. You do it right now. Again, explain to me the common standard that's being held here. Explain to me the common standard. There is no common standard. It just demonstrates that for the left, if you are higher on that intersectional victim scale that I talk about a lot, that means that you are given a higher level of virtue. If you're a gay guy in a locker room, we would never, ever suspect you of being sexually attracted to the guys that you're showering with, which is just silly, okay? That's a silly idea. If I were in a locker room full of women, I would assume that if there were some attractive women there, I would be sexually attracted to them. I don't see why that wouldn't apply if a gay guy was in a locker room full of other dudes, particularly if they're in great shape. Like, this is bewildering to me, but it's considered totally crazy for Amari Stoudemire to say this. It's homophobic. I don't see why it's homophobic to say, I'm uncomfortable showering with people who are sexually attracted to people of my gender. That doesn't seem wildly controversial to me, but it demonstrates that we're willing to make villains out of anyone for saying things where if we just reverse the sex, everything would immediately be called completely legitimate. Okay, time for some mailbag. Yeah, so if you are a subscriber, now is your time. You can write in questions and we'll take some live ones. Okay. Juan David says, they say Hispanics will reach 28% of the population by 2060. How do you see the conservative movement affecting such growing population? Well, you know, number one, demographic charts are always a little bit hard to do just because by 2060 is a long time away. That's a full generation away. There could be a baby boom for some reason. People could start having more babies. People in the Hispanic community could start having less babies. So there's some flexibility to that. I do think that it makes a difference in how conservatives reach out to people who are Hispanic. And that does not mean that you have to take advantage of the immigration issue and make that into your key issue. I think that a lot of Hispanic people are very much for a solid border. But it does mean that you have to be sort of careful about, for example, yelling about Mexican judges. That does not seem like a wise move, particularly. It does mean that you have to actually speak Spanish. I don't think that it is the worst thing in the world. I've been trying to speak Spanish for years. I've been failing, mainly because whenever I talk to people with whom I work who speak Spanish, I get frustrated and start speaking English too soon because, you know, I want to communicate. But I said at the California Republican Party, I was the keynote like a couple of years ago, and I said everybody should speak Spanish, not because English isn't the language of the United States, it is, and not because people who speak Spanish shouldn't learn English, but because the message of conservatism is not restricted by language. If I could speak 80 languages, I'd want to speak 80 languages so I could speak the language of conservatism to everybody. So optics matter, modes of communication matter, and I think that Republicans should get better at all of that. John says, Ben, how would you feel about a constitutional amendment that binds the judiciary to an originalist interpretation of the Constitution? Would such a change be worthwhile? John, well, the problem with a constitutional amendment to do that is that the judiciary could just ignore it, and then how would you enforce it? Presumably it would be an impeachment, but you can impeach judges already. I mean, really, they could impeach judges for not abiding by that already. I think a better constitutional amendment might actually remove the power of judicial review altogether and reverse Marbury versus Madison. And that's a longer conversation, but my basic point here is that the legislature and the executive basically are the ones in control of policy. The judiciary is there to actually just follow the policy, not to determine what the Constitution says. That is an assumption of power that is largely unjustified in Marbury versus Madison, and it's not a great thing that you have an oligarchy that gets to decide what the Constitution means. Kagito writes, hey Ben, who do you think to be the among the left to be your equivalent? That's a hard one. That's a really rough one. I can't think of anybody. I know people who are more on the political left whose thinking I respect, like Sam Harris is somebody who I find an interesting thinker. But as far as people on the hard left, I think Nate Silver's on the left. I respect Nate Silver. I'm not as big a fan of Ezra Klein, but I think he says some interesting things. And there are people on the left who I have interesting conversations. Jesse Singel, I'm friendly with at the New Yorker magazine. He's an interesting thinker, even though we disagree wildly about politics. There are a lot of people on the left who I think are intelligent and can analyze data. As you notice, all the people who I've talked about tend to be very data-driven people. I like data-driven people on the left because at least we have a common frame of reference. I don't like people who just do kind of Michael Moore shouting at the moon stuff. That's annoying to me. Caleb says, hey, Ben, do you believe some of our financial problems come from the deregulation of Wall Street and the financial industry? No, I don't, because I think the deregulation, the regulation of Wall Street and the coordination between Wall Street and Washington, D.C. is really the biggest problem of all. I also think that regulation of Wall Street, listen, you need fraud regulations, obviously, but those are going to continue to exist because that's a basic tort that has existed for hundreds of years. The idea of regulating banks that they can't invest, for example, in certain products, I think that's silly. In fact, I think that there is serious moral hazard that's been created by the idea that the government regulations are going to protect you. I think that that's a really dangerous idea. It makes people rely on the government to protect them when in reality it's not. You know, the government can't protect you from everything. Remember, Bernie Madoff was actually on the board of the SEC. Noah writes, what is your opinion on Young Americans for Liberty, the YAF equivalent for libertarianism? I've worked with Young Americans for Liberty on some campuses. I think that they do a lot of good work. I think that Yale does a lot of good work. As you know, I speak mostly with YAF, but, you know, the students who staff Yale, I know a lot of them. They seem like really good people. Steve says, dear Ben, what would your ideal healthcare system be? Should the government be involved in any way in the healthcare system? So my ideal healthcare system would be a completely free market system in which charitable organizations and religious communities fill the gap. That would be my ideal healthcare system. Because the problem is once you have the government providing a set of perverse incentives for people to basically go out and ignore their own health until the government picks up the tab, you're going to end up bankrupting the system. Now, the best sort of government, if you want to talk about government-run systems that actually work relatively well, the best government-run system that I know of, right, and they're not all created equal. Everybody tends to treat all of these things as equal. The best healthcare system that I know of that is government-sponsored or government-run is the healthcare system in Switzerland. And the way the government healthcare system runs in Switzerland is that basically you are required to buy health insurance. It's sort of like Obamacare, and that covers basic health insurance, but you are also required to spend up to 8% of your personal income on healthcare. And then if the premium is higher than that, then the government will give you a subsidy to help pay for that. Now, I think there's a way to do this without actually even mandating that people buy the health insurance, meaning that we'll cover up to a certain percentage of your cost, right, that if you wanted to have a government-run healthcare system, which I don't, right, I'm now speaking as a Democrat. If I were a Democrat, the system that I would be pushing would look a lot more like the Swiss healthcare system than like Obamacare. And it would require people to pay a heavy percentage of their income into the healthcare system and into premiums in order for the government to subsidize them. It wouldn't be free healthcare. And it would be true for everyone. Poor people also have to spend 8%. The reason being, if you create barriers to entry, then it discourages people from not buying healthcare because the riskier your healthcare gets, the more expensive it gets. And now you're encouraging people to get into it. You know, that's the case for a government-run healthcare system to look more like Switzerland if you're going to have one. I don't believe in a government-run healthcare system because the problem that you have in places like Switzerland, it is a very homogenous, very middle to upper class country. When you have a lot of poor people who live in the system, then immediately you get people who just don't pay. What are you going to do? Fine them? Jail them for not paying? What are you going to do? Have an emergency room system that just takes in people who have, like, I assume that if people haven't bought the basic health insurance, they're not left to die on the street. And in the United States, you know, you have this problem even in places like Massachusetts where ERs, you know, are full of people. Massachusetts has something sort of similar to Obamacare, and it's basically bankrupted the state. It costs more and more and more money. Very difficult to have a system that doesn't cost a fortune as soon as this is the case. By the way, Switzerland does allow private complementary insurance. So that's the Swiss system. If you're going to run a healthcare system by the government, the Swiss system is the best. But I'm not in favor of doing any of that. I think a free market system is the best system because I think that no matter what, people make irresponsible decisions about their healthcare. And if you incentivize people to do that, they will do more of it. Okay, Luke says, I have a lot of friends on the left. They tend to use the condition referred to as intersex as a way to bash people who don't agree with their view on transgender people. How do you feel this condition affects the debate? I don't think the condition affects the debate. The reason I don't think so is because intersex is also a sex. Okay, intersex just means that you were born with two sets of genitals, or it means that you were born with a chromosomal anomaly that makes you like XXY, for example, in which case I believe everyone with like Klinefelter syndrome, I believe everyone who is XXY manifests as a male. So you're basically a male anyway. I'm not sure. Does Klinefelter's make you sterile? I'm not sure what the case is there, but intersex people are not transgender people. Equating the two is just an easy way of avoiding the argument. So when people say, well, you say that there are men and there are women, what about intersex people? Right, intersex people are neither chromosomal men nor chromosomal women. That does not mean you, a chromosomal man, can be a chromosomal woman. And I wouldn't say that an intersex person can be a chromosomal man or a chromosomal woman. I would say they're an intersex person who was surgically manipulated to be more like a man or more like a woman, or who manifests as a man or who manifests as a woman. But the biology doesn't change. As you notice, the way I'm speaking, the intersex person doesn't become a man or a woman. The intersex person is still an intersex person who is manifesting in a certain way, right? That is biology. It is not biology to suggest that just because some people have a chromosomal anomaly, that means that everybody who is XY it can be a woman, and everybody who is XX can be a man. That's so stupid. I can't even speak to how dumb that is. It's really, really dumb. Okay, so the intersex argument carries no weight with me whatsoever. Obviously, it's a tragedy when people are born intersex. It's something they have to deal with, but it doesn't make you a man or a woman, and it certainly doesn't make the case that the outlier is the rule. This is like when people say in an abortion debate, what about rape and incest? Okay, you don't care about rape and incest. You're just using that as an excuse not to talk about 99% of abortions. You know, as I said to that girl at Ferris State in that video that went viral, if she's willing to acknowledge that all the other abortions that are not rape and incest are bad, then we can have a long, complex conversation about rape and incest. You know, because you're using that as an excuse not to talk about the actual cases of abortion. Well, you're using intersex as an excuse not to talk about the fact that men can't magically become women and women can't magically become men. Ben says, hey, as a conservative with a young family in LA, one of the most liberal cities and one of the most liberal states in the country, do you have any insights on the positives and negatives of living and raising children in an environment that often seems outright hostile to your beliefs and values? Well, the negatives, you know, as far as raising kids, that they're surrounded by schmutz every day. They're surrounded by stuff with which I disagree. They're surrounded by culture that I disagree with every day. It's why, you know, I have a religious community in which my kids grow up. It's why they're going to go to private school. I want to inculcate the values that I think are fit for my children, not the values that Michael Moore or Oprah thinks are fit for my children. And that's my decision. I mean, the benefits are that as they get older, they're going to have to be strengthened in their values or they're going to fall. So that's a risky business raising your kid in a leftist area. But sometimes you can come out with gems because of that, because they're pressured from the outside. And that means they're going to have to learn to defend their belief system. Also, LA is great for the weather and it's great for all of the extracurricular activities. They're a great theater scene. There are a lot of benefits to LA, but politics is not one of them. Nathaniel says, Ben, as a Christian, I believe love is one of the greatest actions to show. I plan on being a father soon and want your opinion on what you think is the single greatest value to instill in our children. Responsibility. Responsibility, honor, respect, right? They're really the same thing. But responsibility, the idea that your child is responsible for his or her actions, there is a cause and effect to life, and that what your kid does matters. You know, love is an important thing to show, but you're going to love your kid no matter what. I mean, parents love their kids even when their kids are being complete jackasses. So love is really not on the table. The real question is what level of responsibility you're going to inculcate in your children. And if you don't inculcate a level of responsibility, they think love is the first priority. If they think love is the first priority, they are likely to abandon responsibility in favor of love. People who abandon responsibility in favor of love end up living extraordinarily unhappy lives. because when you're led around by your emotional chain, you're not likely to build a values-laden life that creates solidity and satisfaction, because human satisfaction does not spring only from the feeling of love, which varies from time to time. And especially love that is unmoored to values, which really varies from time to time. Satisfaction in life springs from accomplishment in accordance with a set of values that helps you, your family, and other people. That's where happiness comes from. That's what you can inculcate in your child. Lan says, if Oprah continues to pursue the presidential office, is she in effect validating Trump as a celebrity president? Yeah, I mean, but the Democrats already did. Obama was already the first celebrity president. Obama was just male Oprah with a little bit more political know-how. So I'm not really, I think that Oprah is a little bit late to the scene. Okay, that brings us to the end of this week's mailbag, but we'll be back for more next week. Don't ruin everything while I'm gone. And if you are an iTunes listener, make sure to go over to Daily Wire right now and subscribe, because you're missing out. You could have been part of the mailbag today, but you weren't. You weren't. And you missed out. But you don't have to miss out next week. Go over and subscribe at dailywire.com. I'm Ben Shapiro. This is The Ben Shapiro Show.